He held a gun to his head and told me that if I really felt like he did nothing as a husband and a father, that he would just pull the trigger. And I remember having to look at him and say, no, that's not what I think. And he put the gun down. And I remember just falling to the floor and crying. And he picked me up by my hair, told me that I was selfish for crying because he was the one that was hurting.
Lindsay is a mother of three from Utah County and a survivor of over 18 years of domestic abuse. Now, we haven't disclosed her surname for safety reasons.
He started recording what was happening that night. It was really weird. he was just like going around the house and I was trying to kind of keep him focused on me and not the kids.
She's actually recounting the first time her ex-husband got physical with her. As she takes a sip from her Stanley mug, you can see her hands are shaking.
And he swung around and hit me on the side of the head, and I fell to the bed, and he got on top of me and started choking me, and I remember strangling me, I guess. I don't know what phrase to use. And he started screaming, "Why won't you let me love you?"
Now is probably a good time to mention that all three of Lindsay's children were present during the whole thing.
Like, I didn't know what to do. I was in complete shock. He took our youngest and he locked himself in his gun room with her. And I could hear him telling her that she was never going to see me again. And I didn't know what to do. Like, he had at least 5 guns in that room that I knew about, and the door was locked and I couldn't get her out. And he had told me before that he would never surrender to police. He would go down by police assisted suicide before he would surrender to anyone. And so my mom was saying, like, I'm going to call the police. And I was begging her not to, like begging her not to, because in my mind that was scarier than what I was living in. I just felt broken and scared. I was laying in a bathtub.
Countless DV cases do end in a coroner's report, and people standing around the grave of their daughter, their mother, or their sister asking themselves, what did we miss? Or worse, why did no one listen? Between 2018 and 2022, 109 Utahns were murdered in domestic violence disputes. That's 109 families standing around 109 gravesites. Someone who has stood around one of those grave sites herself is Utah's second highest ranking politician, Lieutenant Governor Deirdre Henderson.
I was sitting in my office, it was August 17th, 2022, and was about to walk out and go get some lunch. And I'd been having meetings all morning, so I hadn't been looking at my phone, but I remember seeing a news alert on the drive-in that morning that there had been a shooting in Taylorsville. And when I got up around lunchtime and was walking out of my office, I looked at my phone and I saw a text from my mother that said the victim was Mandy, my cousin, Amanda Main.
Mandy was shot and killed at a bus stop early one Wednesday morning in August 2022. Police found her ex-husband, Taylor Martin, dead a block or two away with a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
And I went over to my aunt's house where my cousin had lived with her mother, my aunt, and sat in the house with my aunt and Mandy's dad, my uncle, my cousins. And we just sat there in silence for hours. Just stunned. And then the detectives came over that afternoon, and that was the first time that we'd heard, or at least that I had heard, that it was a Wednesday when she was killed, that police had been called to her work that Monday morning and Tuesday morning. There had been 2 interactions with the Salt Lake City Police Department.
So he was known?
He was known. And that was very shocking to me. And I thought, how did we get here? If there were 2 interactions already this week, how did we get here?
In Utah and the United States, domestic violence cases have traditionally been looked at from the perpetrator's perspective, but not so much from the victim's.
Here's what I would do. I would have people start believing women when they say they've been threatened, when they say they've been even verbally abused. It's so easy to dismiss it. That's what happened to Mandy. Over and over and over and over, she called police. My aunt called police. Over and over and over, they were told, that's just talk. That's just who he is. Until he threatened a judge, and then he went to jail for that. But he didn't go to jail for threatening my aunt or my cousin.
What is so hard to believe about a woman saying that she's been hit or something like that by her spouse? Why do you think people aren't believing them?
Well, it's not always a hit, a physical one. And we live in a society that wants to believe the best of people. We have a hard time. And that's a beautiful thing about us, I think, in our state. We want to believe the best of people. So it's really hard to believe the worst. It's much easier, it's much more comfortable to say, wow, I'm sure he didn't mean it. That's a strength and a weakness, I think, in our society.
Now, when it comes to Lindsay, her abuse wasn't actually physical until the last 3 years.
Like, it's really hard to identify that. I think even now it's hard when people are like, but what does he do? And I'm like, I don't really know how to put that into words. It's not as easy as you would like to think it is. So I feel like at the first, it was like very much control and emotional abuse, just making me feel like I couldn't do anything without him, and I wasn't anything without him, and all I was his children's mother. Like, I wasn't even my own human. Like, I was just there to take care of him and the kids. I would wake up and I would lay his clothes out on the bed and I would pack his lunch for work. Like, I got him up and sent him off to work. And so it never felt like I was a human. And so at the first, I think that's what it was. Just kind of conditioning me to think that, like, that's all life is.
How does that happen behind a thin wooden door and yet you go out and people see both of you together, or people see him, and that's what how do you hide that?
I was very loyal to him all the time. I would go rounds with my family. Like, if he felt disrespected or if he felt like they didn't want him at a family party, like, I remember I would call them and just beg them to include him because it was arguments when we got home. But, like, I always had his back. Like, I was his teammate, no matter if I agreed with it or not. Like, if he lost his mind on a random worker at a movie theater one time, they served him a pretzel and the cheese was cold or something, and he got mad and was just a complete butthead. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to treat people like that. And I remember the kid looking at me, and I remember, like, it almost felt like a, like, help me, like, just step in, because he was just so condescending and awful. And I was like, I knew if I stepped in, then it gets redirected to me. And so I just had to let it happen and, like, support that.
If I ran into you in Smith's at the peak of your abuse, what would I have seen?
I mean, at the peak, I wasn't allowed out of the house. So I think that's hard.
Okay. What about, like, I mean, you went through roughly 18 years of it. I suppose what I'm asking is, like, what would have been some red flags that people might have noticed? Like, oh, maybe check in.
I think I wasn't allowed to invite people over to the house anymore, where, like, before I was. So I think, like, people that I normally would have over, like my sisters or my aunts or anyone like that, no one was coming over to the house anymore. And if they would bring it up, I would find a way to uninvite them in a nice way. I don't ever want to make anyone feel bad, right? But I knew what I was allowed to do and I knew what I wasn't allowed to do. And so I think my behaviors shifted a lot, and, like, I avoided conversations because I didn't want to have to justify what he did or tell someone no that I couldn't help them or whatever the case was, right? So I just avoided all humans.
There are several faces of domestic violence: the victim, the perpetrator, the police who investigate, the attorneys who defend and prosecute, and finally the legislators who sponsor bills that hopefully advocate for survivors. Sergeant Spencer Cannon is a police officer, and he's been part of the Utah County Sheriff's Office for the best part of 33 years.
I mean, I remember I had a domestic violence case that was out in Eagle Mountain. I wasn't working out there at the time, but I was working in that area one night, and there were other deputies there. One of them was talking to the husband, who in this case was the suspect. Another was talking to the wife, and I was out in the garage with a 7-year-old little boy. And this 7-year-old little boy, he looked at me and said, "So is my dad going to jail tonight?" And I said, yeah, he probably is. But it wasn't that he asked me that that was so disturbing and so sad. It's how he asked me that. He asked me that as though he were saying, is there any milk in the fridge? It was so routine for that 7-year-old little boy to see his mom and dad involved in that kind of interaction with each other, a violent interaction, that he just said with almost no emotion, is my dad going to jail tonight?
It's very easy for the media or the public to point the finger at the police officers and ask, why didn't they do more?
We want to do anything we can to protect children, if they're victims or if they're just observers. We want to do anything we can to protect the victim, the wife or the husband, whoever it is. But we also feel the other emotions. We want to take somebody out in the woodshed and just let them have it. And of course, we can't do that.
Have you ever left a scene and you knew the next time you were coming back it was going to be with the suicide?
It was going to be worse.
Yeah.
You get that feeling sometimes, you know, this is going to happen again. Utah's law is pretty specific on the responsibilities of law enforcement when they respond to a domestic violence call. We have to have at least some evidence. The standard is typically probable cause to make an arrest. I don't want to say we play games with probable cause, but with domestic violence cases, let me back up a little bit. In any case, we will evaluate the evidence that we have and does it support the elements of a crime. And those are difficult. And we recognize that very often, once those reach the prosecutorial level where charges would be filed in court, it may end up that they have an unwilling witness, and that's common in domestic violence cases, and that they end up not being able to prosecute because they don't have a willing witness.
That right there, what Spencer touched on just then, the unwilling witness or victim, it's one of the biggest brick walls when it comes to prosecuting domestic violence cases. Defense lawyers like Greg Scordis deal with it almost every time they're in court.
I have a trial today. Today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not uncommon to other cases, but he's charged with a domestic violence charge and he's on probation for a domestic violence charge. He already did one. So both cases are being adjudicated today. And, you know, he didn't even make it a year on probation without having another incident. But they're still together. You know, I talked to him last night and said, we have a trial tomorrow. And he said, she's not going to show up. She's not going to be there. So when we get to trial, I know what's going to happen. The state doesn't have a witness. The case is almost certainly going to be dismissed. And that was the first question I asked him. We have a trial tomorrow. How's your wife? She's great. She's here. We're having dinner. What does she know about court tomorrow? Well, the district attorneys called her. They wanted to make sure she knew about court. And she told him, I don't want to talk to you, and hung up on them.
Hey there. Oh, awesome. Thank you very much.
Greg's been a lawyer for about 41 years now, and he says he's seen a case like the one he just described at least once a week since he started.
Are you worried about the escalation in the cycle of violence?
Absolutely. But I know this sounds awful. That's not my job. I mean, I'm a piece of the puzzle. I mean, I can help him. I can tell him, you need to get in some counseling. I don't ever want to see you again. And it tears you up when you look in the back of the courtroom and see the victim. Because they're just this sort of sad looking, I don't know, I don't even like to look at them, because you can see the fear in their eyes. You know, if I testify against him, he'll be mad. If I don't testify against him, he'll beat me up again. It's a lose-lose. It's a lose-lose. And there's no escape. There's no escape.
How often when the victim testifies, is it guaranteed he's removed or convicted?
Generally, if there's some corroboration. So if the victim testifies and the police have photographs of injuries or something like that, Or there's violence in the house. You know, they go to the house and they can see that there's been a lot of disruption. Furniture's tipped over, that type of thing. Holes in the wall from people punching the wall, something like that. It's more likely that the state, the prosecution, can prevail on their case.
Do you think victims know how easy it could be to get out of this situation?
It's not easy to get out of the situation. I don't think they do appreciate that, because I don't think it is that easy. I know that people think, well, you can just go to the police, you can go to the YWCA or a women's shelter, get a divorce, get a protective order. But what if you have a kid together? You're going to see that person the rest of your life. What if you live in the same city? You're going to probably see that person the rest of your life. What if you work together? Or I mean, there's unless you sort of take on a new identity and move to another state, which is ridiculous. So you can't expect people to do that. You can't escape it.
Is it hard being a defense lawyer to people like that when you've got to do your best because that's your job? How do you balance that?
I don't know. The humanity of it is really hard. The more difficult cases, and we haven't talked about these, are the repeat offenders. The person who just beats his wife or girlfriend every month or so. And she calls the police, they come, there's a protective order, and 2 weeks later, he's at the door again, and she just is, like, she just can't deal with it. Like, okay, come in. I know what's going to happen, but it's better than the alternative. And, you know, those are the cases that break your heart. Because then you think, just being a father myself, you know, like, at what point does a woman say, enough, I'm not going to do this? But they get, you can just tell, you can just read between the lines that they get beaten down to the point where they're too tired to escape, to fight back, to say, I'm not doing this anymore, go away. They just don't do it.
Now, if you ask anyone within the DV world, whether it's a defense lawyer like Greg or a police officer like Spencer, getting a victim to give evidence or testify against their offender is extremely difficult. But if you ask a survivor like Lindsay, leaving their abuser is even harder.
I slept in the same bed as him that night. I think I had sex with him that night. He broke my phone in the closet and I had no way to call anyone or do anything. I know that there's a picture of me snuggling on the couch with him the next day. Like, that whole week we were in the house with him and I had no way out. And I remember asking the kids, we've got to go. And she's like, I can't leave him again, Mom. He made me feel so bad last time. I can't leave him again. And I couldn't leave the kids. So I just felt like I was stuck.
This is the entrance. And you'll notice when we go downstairs, the group room is downstairs. So that then guys who are coming for outpatient, guys who are...
People who work with survivors say physical domestic violence doesn't start with the face of the victim. It starts with the fist of the abuser.
It's intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
So often, in order to get somebody to comply with what you want, you don't have to use violence every time.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm giving directions for how to be
how to do it better, how to use power and control better.
Well, all right,
it is true, right? Like, we often will talk about how, like, the physical violence is sort of the punctuation of a really long, drawn-out paragraph, sentence, life of incremental coercion, manipulation, intimidation, fear kind of things. And that look is a look that has been built up in the house, right? It's built up in the relationship.
Jana Fulmer and Martha Burkett-Fawless co-founded a halfway home for those abusers to get help and find ways to change, and it's called My Auntie's House.
So that comes from very much a Southern thing where if you are not able to be in your house and behave appropriately, or as they might say where I'm from, come correct. If you cannot come correct.
If you are displaying a lack of home training.
There we go. It's a lack of home training. Then you may be sent to go stay at your auntie's house for a little while. And she's going to say, come sit next to me. And she will have you helping around the house. You're going to be helping to cook. You're going to help clean. You're going to do yard work. You do all these things to learn how to have some home training and display that you've got that training before you go back home.
How does that align with where we're at right now?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's why we named it My mm-hmm. Auntie's House. We're at a residential treatment facility for people who've used violence in their relationships.
Yep, and they are not, they have not displayed an ability really to be able to stay in their home safely.
So we ask them to come stay with us mm-hmm. and learn how to be a part of a house, how to have conflict and resolve conflict.
Because you're going to have conflict when you live together.
Yeah, and then maybe they go home and maybe they don't, but that's on the entire family to make that decision.
Now, as to the type of people who might get referred to My Auntie's House.
All of the above.
All of the above, as well as like Department of Children and Family Services, if maybe they've been called in for a case for various reasons that they get called in. Yeah, so anyone could be referred in because anyone could be an offender or someone who used violence or a victim or a survivor of domestic violence. Anyone.
What's interesting is My Auntie's House is actually just one of two facilities in the world that focuses on perpetrators of domestic violence. And the only other one is in Israel.
We do work with the whole family. One of the things, though, you have the mental health world, right? And then you have maybe like the forensic element of that mental health world. And you have a lot of people in domestic violence or who come into the domestic violence world and they want to work with survivors and victims and children. And that's wonderful because that's needed, right? Certainly all kinds of things can happen to affect you, right, when you have been traumatized in that way. A lot of people struggle with the idea of working with people who've used violence, who have been the ones that caused that trauma.
I don't know how you can work with those people.
That's what we hear a lot. I can see where you could have that attitude. There's also this place, though, where you realize that this person who used violence is going to be in another relationship, mm-hmm. right? And then the more you work with survivors and victims and children, the more you hear from them that they don't want the relationship to end necessarily. They just want the violence to stop.
Can you fix them?
Yeah, can you fix them? And the answer is a big no. We can't fix them, but we can absolutely make a space where they can work to fix, if you will, quote unquote, fix themselves.
Martha and Janet both actually started in the DV realm, dealing with the victims and the violent conclusions of these dysfunctional relationships.
When I went back to school to get my master's, I was coming from a place where I had been a children's advocate at a domestic violence transitional housing, and I wanted to work with children. And my supervisor said, I'm going to put you in a perpetrators group. And I said, the hell you are. And she said, no, I think you're going to like it. And so I went and just sat there and watched for the first few and then started to figure out that these are people's children and they are hurting and they do want to make changes. The guys who showed up to that group in Heber so long ago, they came because they wanted to make a difference. They didn't want to do the things they were doing. They didn't want to act the way they were acting. And they wanted to be better fathers and better husbands. Mm-hmm. And that is what drew me in.
On the other hand, Jana started her career in forensic science.
I worked the kind of cases, I saw the kind of cases where you have someone who, well, you come in, of course, when you're working with crime scene, you come in at the end, right? It's like at least the end of an event that's happened, and you walk in and you see like broken windows and things happening, and maybe you see a woman's body laying across the plate glass window in the bushes, right? And she's holding a baby. And you see the police are trying to get this man out of the house. And not in like they're trying to like get his gun or anything away from him. He didn't have a gun. But they're trying to keep him from harming himself because he's now come out of
he's distraught
and he sees that he has killed his wife and his child, and even the police are crying, like everybody's upset, you know. So it's that kind of thing is what I think about when I'm sitting with someone who hasn't gotten there yet, but they have used violence, and I think in my head, what can we do to keep this person's partner and children from being laid across the bushes in a plate glass window.
Now, the hypothetical that Jana just described is actually from a very real case she worked years ago. And as she tells it, one thing is abundantly clear. Both of these women have sat in front of hundreds of Lindsays. But what's even more apparent is they've both looked into the eyes of 100 more versions of Lindsay's ex-husband.
Back in the day, years ago, when we were first starting to work together at a different agency, we used to show this this video. Remember the vignettes? Mm-hmm. It was called Hidden Victims, I think. Mm-hmm. It was on a VHS. You have to truck the you know, the big cathode ray TV in and yeah. all the guys. Exactly, right? And all the guys would be sitting in and you hit play. And they'd be these scenarios often of, like, women and children fleeing domestic violence or violence happening in the home. And I think, weren't there some that had child abuse happening in the home?
Yeah, there was one with the kid hiding behind the couch.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And we would show it to the guys, right, because we want to have conversations about healthy dynamics and trying to garner empathy, because that's one of the things in working with people who abuse violence is you're looking for empathy, accountability, and behavior change. One of the things that would happen when they would watch these videos is they would not first off begin identifying with the offender in those videos. They were identifying with the child.
Lindsay admits there are elements of this in her ex-husband's life.
There was a lot of trauma in his past and in his childhood, and he shared that with me pretty early on. And I think that because I am naturally a kind of person that wants to take care of people and nurture people, I think we connected over that. His birth dad ended up giving up rights to him and his brother and his sister when they were young, and he divorced my abuser's mother, and she got remarried. And his stepdad adopted him. And so it was essentially the same situation that we're living right now, his birth dad did to him. And when we were dating, he had a couple of interactions where his birth dad would come back into his life and wanted to be a part of his life, but he was very scared of him.
According to Every Town for Gun Safety, 70 women are shot to death by their intimate partner every month across the United States. And women who live in households with access to guns are 5 times more likely to die than those who don't. Lindsay's ex-husband is a restricted person, which means he is not allowed to own firearms.
He owned a lot of guns before his arrest, and I knew that they were still in his possession, and he would always told me, like, I'll go bury them in the mountains or I'll sign them over to someone else. And so I remember asking my victim's advocate, like, what now? Because now my kids are going to have to go over there, and I know he has these guns. And she's like, well, it's too much of a risk, so we don't make them turn them in. They can voluntarily turn them in, or if they get caught with them, then they're in trouble. And I was like, cool. So I just have to send my kids there knowing he has all these weapons. And unless he gets caught with them, there's nothing they will do about it.
Can you call the police on him?
I could.
Hey, this is a restricted person with guns.
They would have to catch him using them, is what I've been told.
So this is actually true, as Sergeant Spencer Cannon explains.
With any case, you have to have a really reasonable suspicion to be able to conduct an investigation. We can stop anybody on the street and say, hey, do you mind talking to me? And if they say pound sand, then we can't talk to them. If we have somebody that we believe may be involved because one person said, and we say, well, did you see the guns in their possession? If they are a witness and says they are, that might make it so that we can move forward with an investigation. But if somebody just suspects that someone has them, we've got to have more than just a hunch.
What Spencer is essentially paraphrasing here is the Fourth Amendment, which bluntly prohibits searches and seizures without warrants. But the problem is there's an unintentional consequence. Sometimes it prevents police from removing weapons from a restricted person. Now, a good example of this is Terence Voss. You may or may not have heard of him, but in 2021, he shot and killed his girlfriend. Now, he was a known gang member to police, and between 2007 and 2017, he had at least 7 felony gun charges, which means he was a restricted person. Out of the 109 Utahns murdered in domestic disputes between 2018 and 2022, 59 were killed with a gun. 18 of these murders were committed by restricted people. The man who murdered Lieutenant Governor Deirdre Henderson's cousin Mandy was also a restricted person. And just a side note, Deseret News' Kyle Dunphy led this part of the interview.
How do you take guns away from restricted people?
What's the point of being restricted?
Yeah.
Well, from my understanding, if he's restricted, he shouldn't have guns, and if he does, they should be taken away.
True, but the police won't take them away unless they are serving a warrant at their house or he gets pulled over and he has guns. They'll seize the guns, but just being restricted, they won't go in and actually seize the guns unless they have an issue to, a reason to. And so is that something that can be solved?
That is definitely, if that's true, that they can't unless they have a different reason other than the fact that they know he has guns and he's a restricted person, then maybe that is definitely something that should be looked at.
Is there an appetite to try to pass bills like that?
Well, I think so. I think people who believe and revere the Second Amendment, and I'm one of them, also believe that there's certain people who should not be having guns.
Yeah.
And restricted people are some of those people that should not have guns. The legislature has enacted some policies. They've made it clear that that's their intent in many ways. And so I think the worst thing for people who are believers in the Second Amendment is to have people out there who shouldn't have guns having easy access to guns. Mm. The question is, how do we get from here to there? And it is politically challenging. There's no question. My cousin's ex-husband was a restricted person. He went out 2 days before he murdered her and paid cash for a ghost gun. It was very easy for him. And then he walked into a cattle ranch and bought 100 rounds of ammunition the day before. It was very easy. Yeah, we could do better there, and we need to.
Hey, how are you? Cheers. Don't mind me. I am Kyle.
Gun rights are held firmly in Utah, which means any bill or suggested legislation that could possibly challenge Second Amendment rights is very tough to pass. The state lawmakers know this, and senators like Stephanie Pitcher are still sponsoring plenty of bills focused on domestic violence from the legal perspective.
It's really traumatizing. And when you think of all of the different types of criminal cases that are filed in the system, domestic violence cases are very unique in the way that the case impacts the victim, right? Mm-hmm. You could have somebody, a victim of a vehicle burglary or credit card fraud, and you can bring those victims into court, and the experience for them is going to be different than a domestic violence victim, mm-hmm. right? And so I think as a matter of good public policy, we ought to find a way to make those cases, to give prosecutors the tools that they need to properly prosecute and take those cases through the process. And doing it twice wasn't a good system.
Senator Pitcher is a prosecutor turned legislator. She's talking about a bill that put domestic violence cases through the district court rather than the justice court. Now, what this means is once the judge swung their gavel, that's it. No retrials, and victims don't have to go through the same confusing, long-winded court system more than once. Survivors like Lindsay will tell you once is already too much.
That was really difficult. So obviously when I left with nothing. I had no bank account. I had no car. I had nothing. So I had a job, and that was great, but I had to set up a new bank account and start accumulating some things. That took a little bit, right? And none of the money that was in the bank account I could get. It was all just there. He had it, and I never got any of that, which is fine. But because of that, I couldn't hire an attorney, so I went with Utah Legal Services, and I'm so grateful that that is there, right? Because it is helpful for some people. But in my situation, because we couldn't just go to divorce, we had to wait for jury trial to conclude because he was still asking for 50-50 custody. And I was saying, no, you're up in the night. I'm not doing that. And so we had to wait for jury trial to conclude. And so because of that, I went through four attorneys or something like that, four or five attorneys with Utah Legal Services. And by the time we hit actual trial, my attorney had called me the night before and she was like, I'm just looking at your file and this is outrageous. And I'm like, you're telling me.
Utah as a state is making a conscious effort against domestic violence. In 2018, seven bills focused on DV were sponsored, but only three passed. Whereas this year, 9 out of 10 bills were passed. One of the more recent reforms looked at changing bail to be set on risk rather than finances. Now, the bill was introduced in 2020, but it wasn't passed until the following year, and the concept was inspired by a case that Senator Pitcher dealt with as a prosecutor.
prior to bail reform, I, again, was working as a prosecutor in Davis County, and I inherited a case of a young boy who, well, he was about 22 years old, and he was charged with third-degree felony forgery. And I inherited the case. The case was recently set for trial, and I'm looking through it. And in this case, what this individual did is he was a pizza delivery driver. He delivered a pizza to a customer and took the receipt, and then he added a $5 tip to himself, and he signed the receipt. Eventually was discovered, got charged with third-degree felony forgery.
Nice.
Right? He was a punk 21, 22-year-old kid that made a mistake for which there are consequences, right? But he was arrested, booked into the Davis County Jail, and a bail was imposed that he wasn't able to pay. Mm. He had a nominal criminal history. He did have one prior felony offense. It was from about 3 years ago. But otherwise, a nominal criminal history and an excellent record of appearing to court. He had always made his court appearances. But he ended up spending 92 days in the Davis County Jail on a charge for which he had not been convicted because he didn't have the money to bail out.
Mm. For $5.
A $5 tip. Mm-hmm. He spent 92 days in jail because he couldn't bail out.
Yeah.
And that really troubled me. And then I'll give you another example of a case I saw about a month after that as I was handling initial appearances in court. And a defense attorney came up to me and he said, my client's here with me. There's an outstanding warrant for his arrest. He said, go ahead and take him into custody. My client has the $100,000 needed to bail out. Well, this guy was charged with first degree felony rape. And he presented himself in front of the court. He was taken into custody. He probably didn't spend more than 3 or 4 hours in the Davis County Jail before he put $100,000 cash up front and was out the door that same day. And so when I looked at these two cases, just as these two anecdotal cases that I think are very representative of a very large scale problem in our criminal justice system, which is that our pretrial decisions are based solely on wealth, on how much money you have, with no consideration at all about an individual's risk. And maybe there was some consideration. If it was a big case, a higher dollar amount would be imposed. And I think prosecutors were all crossing their fingers that that individual just didn't have the money to bail out. Well, sometimes they did. I had a colleague that was prosecuting an attempted murder case. I think it was a murder case, actually. The guy found the money and bailed out. I mean, that's crazy to me. And so we were seeing problems on both ends.
Thanks to another high-profile bill this year, police across the state are mandated to conduct a lethality assessment when called out to a domestic violence complaint. Now, what this means is they ask a series of questions to the victim, and based on their answers, officers determine how at risk that person is to die.
Well, we've taken a very narrow approach to domestic violence in general, right? The lethality assessment, the statewide database, those are meant only for intimate partner violence. So the broader domestic violence is not necessarily addressed with these tools. But it will be interesting to see over time, especially with the domestic violence task force, mm-hmm. that can analyze the data as it comes in. And we've gotten some really good data so far.
Lieutenant Governor Deirdre Henderson is passionate about the lethality assessment, and one of the features of the legislation is a statewide database. Police can check this on the way to a scene to get the DV history of that individual, regardless of what jurisdiction they're in.
It'd be very interesting to see, you know, really where we are, take a holistic look at what we have going on right now in our state, because we've never done that before. And then that will help us identify where we can go next.
What the lethality assessment has exposed, though, is Utah's serious shortages in facilities for victims and perpetrators. Women's shelters across the state are full up. Even progressive programs like My Auntie's House only has like 9 beds. Yet the number of violent perpetrators in Utah completely dwarfs that.
We have to take care of the problems that we do know about right now. That's going to require money. It's going to require a lot more money. We're beating the bushes here in terms of identifying people who are at a high risk of lethality, being high risk of being killed, and we're finding them. In fact, so far it's looking like almost 2/3 of the people who have lethality assessments conducted are at a high risk of being killed. And those now are required to be connected to victim services. That's what the new statute says. And our service providers, our community providers throughout the state are doing incredible work, but they're significantly underfunded. And the state put in a whole lot of money this last legislative session, and it was historic. It was wonderful. It was not nearly enough. We have to do more. There's been a cut in federal funding, and all of this at the same time is now a big push to help get these victims connected to services that will help save their lives.
Funding is just part of the puzzle. Another piece for survivors like Lindsay is the people.
I think one thing that really helped me out is one of the officers in Spanish Fork that showed up for his arrest in 2019 was also present for his arrest on January 2nd, 2021. And that police officer was the one that interviewed me in our home that night. And I think that I felt safer because it was someone that I knew, if that makes sense. Like, 'cause there's so many people coming in and out and you don't know. And they were all wearing masks at the point. Like, you know what I mean? Like, right. It was just so intense and I'm distraught and I haven't slept in a week. And you know what I mean? And so having someone that had seen me a year prior and he was like, no, like we were here. Like it was really helpful for me to have like that person. I lucked out big time in having him there and he remembered me. Like one of the first things he said is, you probably don't remember me, but I remember you.
What's that like to hear?
It was intense. Like even now saying it, sorry. I never thought that I was a weak person. And I think that he made me feel weaker than I ever thought I could. And having someone, like, it was almost like it was like being called out, right? I couldn't make any rationalizations or justifications. I couldn't say it was a one-time thing because I had someone there standing in front of me that saw it a year prior. And so it was just, I don't know. He saved my life. Him and the victim's advocate in Spanish Fork are the reasons I am here today.
Tell me about when you met Andrew.
He was taking out the garbage. So I met him in like March of 2021. Was that about it?
Lindsay has a new husband, Andrew, who she married earlier this year.
I fire hosed him, essentially. Like, I was very scared to like him. And I was very upfront with that. And I just said, like, if you're going to like me, I want you to know all of it. Like, here you go. I never thought I would find anyone that's going to be like, okay, yes, let me date you and your three children. Like, yes, that's a lot. That's huge. I tell him that all the time.
Andrew is a firefighter in Utah County. He has a quiet demeanor. He likes his fishing, his hunting, but he loves Lindsay and her three kids.
I never looked at Lindsay as like, oh, I'm dating the survivor of domestic violence, or I'm married to a survivor of domestic violence, because Lindsay still is who she is. Like, it was a conversation we had this morning. Like, I love her for who she is, not what she's been through. That's just an added component of our lives.
Lindsay has full custody of her kids now, and Andrew is in the process of adopting them as his own. But parenting three children who have seen the level of violence that Lindsay's have is a challenge in itself.
We were sitting right here. She was sitting in this chair, and I don't remember the conversation, but it was actually like...
We were proud of her.
Yeah, like, good job. And I stepped forward and overhand went to high-five.
You can underhand high-five her, but you can't overhand
and
high-five.
And I did this, and she went like this immediately. And you want to talk about soul-crushing. To watch a six-year-old child when you go to give them a high-five, which is like a sign of, hey, good job, or like, you know what I mean? To watch her flinch like I was about to smack her was absolutely soul crushing. And we, at the moment, we just kind of played it off. And I was like,
no,
like, what
okay.
about what about a low five, you know? And she gave me that, right?
Bodhi is our brand new addition to the family. He's a teacup golden doodle. So he's more of an emotional support pet. He stays tiny forever and kind of looks like a chicken nugget. So.
Yeah, he's an Instagram dog. Yeah. I've only seen those
he
online.
He is. He's a Pinterest dog.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chicken nuggets, perfect.
Yeah.
You have to approach it very open-minded, I think is what I've come to realize. I think what the big thing is, my mom remarried, I think I was 6 years old, and it wasn't that talking about my dad was off limits, but it just didn't happen. And as I grew up later in life, like, it was kind of one of those things. It was like, well, is it taboo to talk about him, not to talk about him, whatever the case may be. And so
I kind of tried to set the understanding that it wasn't an off-limits topic. We could talk about anything that's ever happened. We could talk about their dad. We could, like, it wasn't something that was like, oh, we can't talk about that because he's here, but when he's gone, I can talk to mom about it. And so I tried to foster that very open environment of, like, we can have these conversations. I've been through a lot of the things that you have been through, so we can talk about that because I do have a different perspective on it than Lindsay does. So just try to be that supportive role, and like, but you can't force that with them. And so it was just, I don't want to say necessarily love from a distance, but kind of love from a distance and let them come to you.
In one way or another, everyone you've heard from in this podcast has been impacted by domestic violence.
These homicides they're preventable. People are dying who obviously shouldn't be dying.
Before clearing her desk tonight and heading home, Lieutenant Governor Deirdre Henderson will think of her cousin Mandy once more. As he drives through Utah County, Sergeant Spencer Cannon's mind will turn to the 7-year-old boy and wonder where he is right now. Greg Scordis will close yet another file on another man facing his third DV charge and hope he never sees him again before heading home to decompress with his wife and daughters.
Those are the ones that scare you a little bit because they are the guy next door. It is, you know, the person in the next office to you. Those scare you.
Tomorrow, Jenna and Martha will look another broken man in the eye and try to help him fix himself. And Lindsay and Andrew are working their way through it, step by step, hand in hand.
Just crazy busy, and busy is fine. I will take busy all day long, but I mean, I feel like happy is the understatement of the century. Right. I never thought life like this existed. I tell him that all the time. Like, I never thought love like this existed. I thought that I knew what love was, but I know now that I definitely did not.
We asked everyone in this story one question. If you ruled the world, how would you fix domestic violence? All of them said education. Every child in America learns about who Christopher Columbus is at school. But do American children know what a healthy relationship looks like? And after listening to this, do you?